From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's second hour of Forum, UCSF neuropsychiatrist Luann Brizendine will join us to discuss her new book, The Female Brain, which is full of what distinguishes the way women think and feel and what separates them from the men. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum, our second hour. Luann Brizendine studied science, medicine, and psychiatry at Berkeley and Yale and taught in the medical school at Harvard and found there was little or nothing about female biological or neurological differences outside of pregnancy. An MD and neuropsychiatrist at UC San Francisco, she established the nation's first clinic to study women's brain structure, function, and mood. The Women's and Teen Girls Mood and Hormone Clinic, and after 2 years of neurobiological research, has published a book called The Female Brain. She's a Bay Area resident, and she joins us for this morning's second hour forum. And welcome. Good to see you.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Well, the emphasis in your book gets down to kind of hormones and neurology to a great degree. I mean, if we want to be simplistic about it, because it's very complex. But it gets down also to some real gender differences. Women, much less predictable, sort of like the weather, you say.
Well, I think what's important to remember, Michael, is that we all start off with basically the same brain structure until about 8 weeks of fetal life. And then at that point, the tiny testicles in the male brain start pumping out lots of testosterone that goes to marinate that male brain, changing it for what's a basic female structure into a male structure from about 8 weeks of fetal life up to 20 weeks and continues to be tweaked. And then, of course, at birth, the male and female brain have the typical male and female circuitry, and male circuitry gets stimulated all during life by testosterone, and females get stimulated by their estrogen and progesterone and testosterone starting at the teen girl stage.
Yeah, you're right about teen girls. In fact, some of these teen girls come off drama, you say, when you start your chapter on teen girls, and we'll talk about all these other differences in the brain, but obsessed with how they look, won't get off the phone. You read this and you think, what about all those dorky teenage girls, or the teenage girls who don't use like a lot to punctuate their sentences, or teenage girls who simply don't want to sit on the phone or care about their looks? I mean, there's a wide continuum here, isn't
it? I think what's important to remember is that there are individual differences, and every woman that reads this book and every man that loves women that reads the book actually finds, you know, they compare it to the women in their lives or to themselves at different stages, and there's a lot of individual variation. But all of the studies, of course, are done to compare the average typical female to the average typical male, and then they look at the differences, and that's called the gender difference. And the teen girls that, the teen girl brain circuits that get turned on by their hormones is, of course, you know, sadly we haven't studied a lot of the male hormone surges of testosterone and all of their behavioral effects. Of course, that's a subject of another book. But the teen girl brain gets turned on for her interest in sex is expressed, Michael, in wanting to pull the attention of usually the opposite sex to them. So everything that they can do, they think about how to dress to attract the opposite sex. They obsess about their weight. They think, is he gonna think I'm too fat? Is he gonna think I don't have big enough boobs? Is he gonna think I'm this, that? You know, so it's all the media doesn't actually make it happen. It just plays upon the natural circuitry that turns on in the teen girl brain of wanting to try and figure out how in her life she's going to attract a mate. And that's what we've been hardwired for millions of years to do.
You put a lot of emphasis on nature, actually. And I know that this is difficult because I know you're a card-carrying feminist and you have good bona fides where feminism is concerned. But it's difficult to navigate, isn't it, between nature and nurture here? Because when you say men and women aren't equal, their brain structures are different. Men think about sex much more. Women are much more emotional, communicative, have more connection to emotions and so forth. You're running a risk, aren't you, of somebody saying, well, there's differences here, and maybe the differences ought to apply to the workplace, or they ought to apply wherever.
I think that one of the important things that we need to remember that I think is really sort of a basic tenet of what we know from neuroscience now, and of course here at UCSF, Michael Merzenich has done a lot of the groundbreaking work over the last 20 years in that, which basically shows that all kinds of nurture, every experience we have, every way that people react to us and interact with us, those experiences and the nurture we get or don't get, so the good, the bad, and the ugly experiences, actually feed back and change the brain cells and brain circuitry. An example can be someone who's born with a lot of musical talent, and by 7 years old, they need to start doing whatever instrument they're going to do, but that practice actually assigns more cells in your brain and makes more circuitry to do that activity. And if, you know, you have natural inclination to be interested in things that girls are versus boys are, those things feed back on our circuitry and actually emphasize the gender differences in some situations. And I think in my era, all of us feminists gave our kids these gender-neutral toys. We were a little surprised when our boys picked up Barbie dolls and used the legs of the Barbie doll as a sword.
Well, you've got a young girl in your book who's got a truck, but she's giving it nurturing, like holding it like a baby and, you know, being mothering and all that. What about someone like, I don't know if you've read Janet Hyde, I suspect you have, from University of Wisconsin.
I use lots of Janet Hyde's work.
Well, but she says essentially that there are gender similarities except for physical aggression and strength and incidences of masturbation and attitudes about casual sex, and I think that's pretty much it for her.
Right, yeah. Her study showed that there are about 25% of the differences she looked at have zero difference. About 47% of her differences showed some small differences, and about 24% showed some significant differences. So I think her work also shows that there's the gamut depending what it is that you look at.
Do we risk, though, generalizing about the sexes, fostering attitudes that would indeed make more generalizations about the sexes that could be invidious?
I think one of the things that we need to focus on is when we look at differences, differences does not mean a reason to discriminate against someone or to have anything be less than equal pay for equal work, and we women haven't made a lot of progress since 1976 on that one. However, I think understanding the differences is very important because it helps us figure out how we need to structure our work environment and our social environment to maximize each individual's ability to become his or her best self and be the most productive member of society that we can have.
So you say Lawrence Summers of Harvard was right and wrong.
I think Dr. Summers really stepped in the middle of a bear trap he probably didn't intend to do. Of course, in retrospect, I'm sure he didn't. I think that what women found most offensive about what he said, Michael, is that he said women don't want to spend 80 hours a week, slaving away in the office at their career. I think what he got entirely wrong is that once we have children and we have very young children, the joke of 80 hours a week is past. That sounds like a luxury. It's you do what you do at the office and then you come home and all of a sudden you do the second shift, and it's usually the mom who's going to relieve the nanny, or the mom who's going to pick up at the daycare, or the mom is running across the street to breastfeed her baby at the daycare center at her workplace. So I think what he hasn't had the experience himself of trying to juggle career and motherhood.
But he was right in a way, you said, about the differences in math and science that take shape, particularly after, again, girls enter the teen years and become much more concerned about how they look or attracting boys and so forth. And I wondered, in reading that, I thought to myself, probably a lot of girls who were discouraged also or not given the proper encouragement. That came up in the whole Summers controversy, as I'm sure you...
Yeah, I think one of the things that we know, Michael, is that both men and women have the same IQ points, and there's a broad spread of what men and women are interested in. I think an example is the Icelandic population, where the girls do better in math and science, which has been a curiosity. And come to find out, lo and behold, it's girls in that society do better in math and science in school, and it's going into the fishing industry that is the big money maker in Iceland. So all the boys are focused on that, not so much on math and science. The girls are the engineers, et cetera, in that society. So I think we also had to look at what the reward systems in a given society is for becoming good at math and science. In ours, you get paid better for being an engineer or being in math and science.
Talking to Luann Brizendine, who is an MD and the author of The Female Brain. She's a neuropsychiatrist at University of California, San Francisco. Talk about sexuality for a moment, because pheromones, I thought I knew a little bit about pheromones, but there's this distinction again about how females are drawn to pheromones, which is quite different and singular in its way, and it depends a lot on the menstrual cycle.
Well, it's interesting to write this, to write The Female Brain. I certainly reviewed all the studies on hormones and 1,008 studies to write the book, and the fascinating ones that were the most fun were the ones on pheromones, Michael, and especially the stimulation during different weeks of the menstrual cycle for women. That right before ovulation, of course, right before ovulation is the best time to get pregnant, as we know. So right before ovulation, women really found that they liked the particular odors of what they might find on a different week were kind of a stinky male T-shirt.
Like your sweat socks or something.
Yeah, that's right. But they really kind of liked those that stinky male smell a couple of days before ovulation. So I think, you know, we know a little bit more how nature, she made it to have the survival of our species.
You think about those arrows coming out of Cupid's, you think about pheromones being airborne. Also, I learned from you that flirting is tied to testosterone.
Well, also at that same stage, Michael, so what we know in the female menstrual cycle during a woman's fertile years is that little phase between phase 5 to 9 or 10 days before ovulation, so in about the second week of your menstrual cycle, female testosterone goes up to its highest peak as well, naturalistically, both the ovaries will make more. And yes, indeed, the testosterone level goes up at the same time. Women at that stage like to flirt more and to flirt more with individuals who may not be their current mate.
Would a woman with more testosterone, therefore, perhaps have a greater libido? I mean, you've used testosterone patches, I know, for example, women with low libido, so it almost seems like that's a given.
Yes, I was going to say there's a joke that runs around the women's hormone clinics that is that if a 19-year-old boy wants to find a 19-year-old girl who has a sex drive that's closer to his than the usual miserable 3-to-1 ratio from a guy's perspective, the thing that causes causes pimples is also testosterone. So he should find a girl with a few pimples.
But is one to assume that these young women who have high libido or high sexual drive are bathing in testosterone through an endocrine system, or is this just maybe, again, the deviations and differences of...
Well, what we know, there's a large variation, Michael. I mean, females tend to have about... men have 10 to maybe 100 times more testosterone than the average female, and that certainly drives the sex brain circuits. And remember I told you that at 8 weeks old, all that testosterone that's marinating the male brain in the fetus, that's changing the brain from female into a male brain, it actually doubles the size of...
So it's two and a half times, you say, in the book, the size of the male brain and
right,
sex drive.
The cells for sexual pursuit, they're called. The cells in the brain for sexual pursuit are at least double in the male brain. And, of course, testosterone then starts to run those a lot. So males tend to have more circuitry for sexual pursuit than the typical female.
And you come up with these figures about 52 seconds for men and maybe once a day for women in terms of their mind moving into the erotic or into the sexual realm. Sounds a bit high for men,
had some men, you'll laugh, because I won't name names, but some men that have told me that was a little low every 52 seconds, of course. And other men say that's a little high. But these, remember, were most of the studies that are done on some of these topics have to do, remember, the people doing the studies are professors at undergraduate universities.
So a wide continuum again, though.
Right.
Really.
So the 19-20-year-old, that was a 19-20-year-old freshman, sophomore in college studies that compared the male and female 19-to-20-year-old. So you're not going to have a 35-year-old male and female maybe having quite that much difference. But I think it's important to remember that the overlap in almost anything you look at between male and female, the overlap is about 10% of females will end up in the male arena in whatever it is that you're looking at, like either sex drive. I have couples come to my office where it's the woman who has more sex drive than the male. That's a problem. And anytime you're mismatched, no matter which direction it is. And then 10% of males will fall in more of a female category in terms of the way their brain works or their interest is. So that 10% overlap is well known both in children's studies. Eleanor Maccabee from Stanford, that's done 40 years of work observing kids in the 3- and 4-year-old play set, that's at 10% overlap. So I think we have to honor individual differences. Anytime you write a book like The Female Brain, you have to write about what the studies show that are on the average that doesn't mean you want to say just because you or someone you know is not that average, typical. Not every woman wears a size 10 dress, right?
I was just remembering a show many years ago when Donahue was still doing television, or before his attempt to create another program that didn't work for whatever reason. He had on a bunch of people who said they were asexual, and this was their identity, and they were discriminated against for their asexuality, but they felt that they had no libido. You have to wonder what's going on in their brains.
Yeah, I think that we have to, that individual differences.
Men and women, by the way.
Men and women. Yeah. So both men and women there are individual men and women who have no interest in sex. And I don't consider any of that necessarily to be on face value abnormal. There's individual variation in just about any aspect of human behavior that you're going to look at. It doesn't necessarily mean, it may not be the average, but does not mean it's necessarily abnormal.
But women are 2-to-1 more depressed than men, right?
Yes, I think that's actually a very important message that I wanted to get out by writing The Female Brain and having studied depression in women for 20 years and knowing that by the year 2010, the World Health Organization's number one disease on the top of that list predicted by 2010 is depression. Since we know it's a 2-to-1 ratio of depression in women over men, that means that the number one disease in the world by 2010 is going to be depressed women.
Talking to Lou Anne Brizendine again, her book is called The Female Brain, and Dan Goleman, who has been on the show a few times, says you finally get a satisfying answer to what women want when you read this book, which of course was what Freud was asking throughout most of his career in Vienna and beyond. Was he right about love? He said that love is a form of temporary insanity. I'm asking a neuropsychiatrist and an expert on the female brain, but in both male and females?
I think that that love state, which is basically a state where your brain is pumping out huge amounts of dopamine, which is the same type of chemical that runs the reward circuits in our brain. People that have taken psychostimulants like cocaine get a similar brief effect. But love, the state of being in love, Michael, is actually a state that has been compared to insanity, in that you become completely obsessed with the beloved, and both males and females get that same kind of obsession, and all you want to think about is what they're like, what they want to do. You actually even start having different interests and tastes that may not have been yours before, but are those of the beloved. And pretty soon you've kind of incorporated lots of parts of them into your life. And, you know, when you're out of town and they're away, you're on the phone 15 times a day to them. You know, I know my husband and I still are on the phone many times a day with each other. I got lucky and married the perfect husband, of course. But, you know, it's very nice to know that state of love and is sort of like insanity, but unfortunately it sort of fades after 6 to 12 months in most people, and then you get back to the business of living.
Taking out the garbage and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. you actually make a case for, baby lust and the mommy brain, these kind of terms that have come down to us almost in popular culture as what they are, a part of the popular culture, but also a part of the brain, as you say.
Yes, and I think a lot of women that have caught baby lust, myself included, you often catch it from somebody holding somebody else's baby right when you're at that time in your life when it's time to get ready to procreate or not. So the smell on the top of a baby's head lets off certain pheromones, Michael, that they have shown actually kind of is a very appealing smell to women of childbearing age. And there's within the infertility clinics, there's also this little lore that you pass a baby around and it helps stimulate a woman's fertility. So that has actually been studied in terms of there is actually a little pheromone, a little chemical substance at the top of a newborn baby's head up till about 6 or 8 months old lets off that is stimulating to other females.
And women have different brains when they give birth. I mean, essentially, the brain has different chemicals, I should say. There is a mommy brain.
Well, I think that when you understand that marinating the brain in higher levels of hormones than usual actually turns on genes in the brain, and it stimulates circuitry that, of course, are in the female brain, but it turns on circuitry for what we euphemistically now call the mommy brain, which is basically behaviors that have been wired in the female brain for millions of years to take care of helpless infants, because, of course, human infants are born more helpless than most offspring, and you know, we first 2 years are pretty high intensity for taking care of the little pups, and we need to have hardwired behaviors where possible to have them survive.
In the review of your book that appeared, many people in San Francisco probably read in the San Francisco Chronicle by Hannah Wallace, she talks about love, getting back to love in a moment, at first sight being more easy for men, and says that you cite, which I guess you do in your footnotes, Helen Fisher, and then she says no explanation of the study or summary of the argument. So maybe we can go on record here at least edifying that, or how do we know that men fall in love at first sight more often?
Well, Helen Fisher's work shows that, first of all, we know that the male brain, Michael, is more highly wired, and this we know this from actual neuroimaging studies, that the visual stimulation of the male brain for looking at female body parts or looking at female figures, or that this actual visual stimulation for sexual stimulation is more in the male brain than the female brain. And of course, the whole porn industry knows that, and they make lots of money off of that.
Even Kinsey knew that, all the things he didn't know.
That's right, even Kinsey knew that.
Showing
that's
statues
right.
of male gods, yeah.
Yeah, so we know that that happens, and that so Helen Fisher's work shows that there's that tendency then for the male brain to really give surges of the dopamine surges to the visual stimulation of the object of desire, and females of course have all kinds of they multitask. They also have many aspects of males that they fall in love with, and it's a little different than the male brain. Not surprising, the guys have twice the brain circuitry for what's called sexual pursuit. The females have a lot of circuitry for attracting the opposite sex.
Different brain circuits, different wiring, and different brain centers. You point out in your book for language and about 11% more neurons than men in those language centers. So women are obviously more verbal.
Yeah, that's out of Sandra Wilson's work in Canada. And there are certain areas of the male and female brain that are just turned on to develop more cells, you know, in fetal development. That shouldn't surprise us. We are a species that has developed in a similar evolutionary niche, but we have slightly different tasks that we need to perform. So the evolutionary psychologists hypothesize that the male and the female have evolved genetically in these different niches, females more to take care of the home and hearth and make sure that the offspring survive, and talking amongst females and female social interactions have been more important to females in the survival of infants, and male seems to have much more visual circuitry. For example, Michael, I think one of the things that astounded me, even though I knew some of these differences before I started writing the book, are several neuroimaging studies that show that you give the male and female in the brain scanner a task, and that you're supposed to come up with a certain answer. Doing this mental rotation of an image out of a couple of the German studies in the last couple of years show that the male and female, they come up with this. We come up with the same answer, Michael, but actual different circuitry lights up throughout the brain to get the same answer, which is quite astounding.
Well, we're going to light up our phones here. In fact, let me give you the phone number and invite you to join us. You are cordially invited to participate with any questions or comments with our guest, Lalanne Brizendine. And your calls, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Lalanne Brizendine, who is an MD and neuropsychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of The Female Brain, and just talking about a really amazing female brain. And we have the same editor, and we're very fortunate to have the same editor. But I want to mention also that Lalanne will be appearing in September at a number of local bookstores, Books Incorporated on Chestnut, Black Oak, Book Passage, and Kepler, and you can call your local bookstore in terms of time and when she'll be there. In the meantime, you can talk with her. In fact, let's go to your calls. Jim, hi.
Hi. Potentially incendiary question, I think, to lead off the question and answer half hour, but I'm wondering what the guest thinks, based on her research, to put it bluntly, on, you know, who ought to be running the world, men or women? women in political leadership positions as opposed to men, given the differences in the female brain and behaviors.
Boy, not only that, Luann, I'm sure you remember that big controversy. Who was the idiot who said, you know, there should never be a woman president because they have menses and that'll put them in a bad mood, or words to that effect? A huge idiotic remark. But what about leadership in men and women in terms of...
I think that the caller's question is really important at this point in time when it's very clear to everyone in the world that having incredible negotiating skills and picking up on emotional nuance and the subtlety of social and cultural issues is a real skill set that we need desperately in the world, obviously not just this country. And as you notice, there are more and more female leaders in the world. So I don't think that women could possibly do any worse.
And let me thank the caller. We'll move along and take more of your calls. Jack, hi, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I read a book a couple years ago named called Flux, and I was wondering if the author has read any scholarly research about women, not in their 19s and 20s, but late 20s, early 30s. You talked about the mommy brain, so obviously I believe that there's research about women, you know, who are late 20s and early 30s, but could you speak more about the research of that and how the female brain changes as time goes on and the average changes?
Luann?
I think the caller is talking about is the phases of a woman's life. And in the female brain, I have, in the very beginning, I have a nice chart that anybody, especially the caller, wants to look at the chart that called the phases of a female's life and brain. So, but the phases in what he's talking about, the 20s and 30s, females are wired just like males are wired to procreate. And I think the choices that males and females make in mates, I mean, if you think about it, the male can inseminate and just go on his merry way. The female needs to gestate for 9 months and then be involved in breastfeeding and raising and having the survival of an infant.
We're back to E.O. Wilson and sociobiology.
Yes, we're back to the sociobiology issue of how we have been wired slightly differently, and this is no surprise that there are differences in brain circuitry in the male and female.
We'll thank the caller and move to more calls here in just a moment. Women over 50 are more likely to initiate divorce than men. Why is this?
Well, Michael, as I write in the female brain, 65%, according to government statistics, of the filings for divorce after the age of 50 go up to 65% are filed by females. And no one knows the reason entirely behind this, but...
you have your suspicions.
We have our suspicions. And having run the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic for many years, I mean, women come and they're sort of fed up. They've raised their kids. They've done a very, they've had them fly from the nest and they're doing fine. And then there they are facing their mate of many years. And depending on the state,
oy vey,
right? What do you do now? And, it's either you like the person or you don't. And before she might have been willing to put up with a heck of a lot in the household to make it a secure place for the kids to grow up. This is an old story, Michael. And then when they're gone, she's sick of taking care of everybody else's needs and she's ready to proceed with her own life.
And symmetrical looking men are better lovers? Do we know that for sure?
Well, that's some surprising data that I discovered in my researches for writing The Female Brain, is that the symmetry studies that females and males, that we all prefer very symmetrical people as mates. And interestingly enough, those symmetrical males that females find very attractive, they find them more attractive for flings rather than necessarily for lifelong mates. So the and finding that the flings tend to be, the according to the research data, Michael, they are the males that females have better and more orgasms with. So this issue of the symmetrical male being a better lover has been something that's come out in the research data that was sort of surprising and provocative to us all.
Now we know what Blake meant by fearful symmetry, huh? more calls. Vanessa, hi, from Georgia. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Interesting topic. You discuss what a man feels when he falls in love with a woman, what a woman feels, vice versa. I am a gay female. What goes on in my brain when I'm in love?
Great question, Ms. And of course, I have an appendix in my book called The Female Brain and Sexual Orientation, specifically written for lesbian women. And all the studies show that that's a hardwiring that's probably present at birth, and it's genetic, and it's not obviously a moral choice. It's just how it is. So my answer to that is that at that stage, at the teen girl stage, when the hormones start flowing and all of the brain circuitry turns on for being interested in attracting a mate and in being attracted to mates, if you have a same-sex attraction, then that turns on just the same way as the opposite sex attraction. So it's who you're attracted to that is wired there, and that turns on at the early teen years for most gay men and women.
And we thank you, Vanessa, for the call, and we go to more of your calls. Mark, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Morning.
Hi. The author mentioned something about female depression rates being about twice as high as men, and I'd wonder if she could talk about that in regard to the suicide rate in men being about four times as high as women, and also the fact that I believe women, on the average, speak about two times as many words per day than men. So I'm wondering if the depression differences that you spoke about could be due to women either admitting it more or talking about it more.
That's a great question. The answer, at least to all of the people who do research in suicides and suicide gestures versus what called suicide completions that you're referring to, males like guns, and they will take more lethal actions.
They're also more aggressive, according to most of your studies. That would mean more aggressive toward the self as well as outward
aggression.
Yeah,
they're more aggressive. The brain circuitry is more aggressive. And then, of course, sometimes when females feel bad, they call up their girlfriend or their sister or their mother, or maybe they'll even try and talk to their brother or their husband. So, yes, females do tend to put things into words, especially emotions into words, more quickly than males. So I like your juxtaposition, and hopefully you'll go into doing some research in this area yourself someday.
Good luck, Mark, and thank you. There's a lot more autism in boys, disproportionate stuttering in boys. I mean, these kinds of things tell us something about brain circuitry, don't they?
I think that, you know, nature has done some selectivity on the male and female brain over millions of years, and we don't understand why it's an 8-to-1 ratio of autism in male to female. And reading disability and learning disability in boys, young boys, is about a 4-to-5-to-1 ratio in boys over girls. That is not entirely understood, but it is indeed thought to have something to do with those testosterone fluxes in the fetal male brain that make some changes.
Although 99% of the genetics is the same, and the boy's brain, the male brain, is just close to a tenth bigger than the female brain, just in size. Yeah.
Right. So I think that what we know in medicine, Michael, is a really important thing for all of us to keep in mind, is that small differences, I mean, 1% of genetic difference is actually huge in terms of the way that it its outcome in all of us. It makes all the diversity we see in the whole human population. So in terms of both diseases and gender and all kinds of things. So a 1% difference, my gosh, in the genetic code in each of us, boy, that's a huge difference, actually, in the way it plays out.
And let's get Barbara on. Barbara, good morning.
Yes, hi. I wanted to say hi to Luann. I've seen her, and she's a great, great researcher and doctor, and I'm so excited that she has a book out. I wanted to ask a question, but then I got a bigger question in my mind. You're talking about the wiring of the brain, and I'm wondering about the evolution of the brain. Has technology and using computers and all of this information overload, has that affected the evolution of the brain wiring in either sex? You know, I know that as man changes throughout time and our bodies change, like, you know, our size of our bodies throughout evolution, I was wondering if that's touched upon in your book at all, or if you know a book about that.
Well, I think that your question is an excellent one, and I think that those people who do research in evolution know that to change how what genes are selected for takes millions of years. And of course, look at our technology. It's the internet's only been around for, you know, less than 20 years. So we're in the very early stages. It's going to take another million years to have an effect on the genetic coding mm-hmm. of the female or the male brain.
Uh-huh. Well, the evolution of the brain changing or our bodies changing takes a very long time, is what you're saying.
It takes a lot of time, yes, indeed.
Well, I had another question. When you were talking about asexuality, not necessarily being abnormal, you used the word abnormal and average, and I wanted you to go into that and define the terms more. What do you mean by average and normal?
Well, I think that all of the studies that look at differences in anything that a study looks at differences in, you have to take what the average was, say, for the females, and the average was for the males, and you compare those two to each other. So the 1008 studies I reviewed to write The Female Brain look at the differences between those averages, and I want to make the point that individual differences are terribly important, and there's lots of overlap between males and females.
And thank you, Barbara. Good to hear from you, and we'll hear next from David. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. My question was regards to fidelity. Lorena, in your studies, have you found that women are more predisposed towards being more faithful in relationships, or have you found that there's no difference between men and women? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for the call. In fact, the Chronicle Reviewer accused you of being a little naive on that score, didn't she? She said.
Well, I think that the data shows that something like 66% of males over their lifetime have some kind of extramarital affair. And in females, it's more in the 30% range. So I guess that means if you put them together, that means a lot of females are having more than one affair. But the fidelity issue, of course, genetic studies of different diseases have discovered what genetic researchers refer to as the dirty little secret of genetic studies, which is that about 10% of the people they're studying indeed are not the offspring of the males who are sure that they are the father. So it's in the 10% range. So we do know, of course, that females do have flings on the side that result in pregnancy and offspring.
Talking to Luann Brissendine, her book is The Female Brain, and let's go to Ralph. Ralph, you're on. You're on I-5, in fact, aren't you?
Yes, I'm headed down the Central Valley here, headed toward L.A. But it's very interesting, and I appreciate you taking my call, but my question for your guest was, I'm a male, and I'm not a homosexual. I'm a very masculine, but I had an endearment.
By the way, there are masculine homosexuals, very masculine
okay,
homosexuals.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Anyway, I had a very endearing mother, and she was doting over me, and also I had two older doting sisters, but I also had a good relationship with my father and male friends and that kind of thing, but my entire life I have had female tendencies like decorating things, attention to details. I love to cook. I love to prepare a table. The whole plethora of things that are normally viewed as female type things. So I was just wondering if maybe you could elaborate on that.
Well, I guess that you're going to have a lucky wife then, because you guys are going to have more in common. I think that you are a wonderful example of how there's huge diversity in both males and females. And some females really like to do guy type of stuff. And a lot of males like to do what's the more typical, stereotypical female type of stuff. And I think that there is huge individual variation that we must honor.
Doesn't have to be a physiological basis in his case.
Doesn't have to be a physiological basis.
Let me thank you for the call, Ralph. Enjoy your cross-fertilization, as Mencken called it, of gender. In fact, I think it was Mencken and Ashley Montague who believed that some combinations of male and female made for really the most interesting and distinctive kind of personalities, or often artistry and all of that sort of thing. But men generally, as you point out, have a far more difficult time remembering things, particularly like what the woman that they fall in love with was wearing on the first date, or what song was playing, or...
Yes, Mike, I think a lot of people have enjoyed the emotions chapter in the Female Brain book, because it brings out the differences. And the research studies show that in terms of emotional detail and remembering emotional detail, of course, there's that area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is larger in females, whereas the amygdala is a bit larger in males, and that's the area for fear and aggression. But the hippocampus tags memories and puts them into long-term memory. Females tend to have a much better memory for things like the details. They can remember where they were standing in the house when they had a fight 10 years ago with their spouse, and what was going on, what the guy was wearing, what they were wearing, what was happening in that room. So the details are all encoded in their memory banks. The guy may not even remember that the fight happened at all.
Mark, joining us from Brisbane. Morning.
I have two quick questions. First of all, thanks for having this show on the air. This is a great show. And second, I was wondering, how do these numbers and statistics hold up with cross-cultural studies? I know you mentioned Iceland, but how are they different? Do the same things hold up when we go to Africa or when we go to Asia? And also the second question, which I think is more important, is how do you want or expect this book and these statistics to impact public policy? And I'll go ahead and take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
That's a very broad question, but I want to answer the first one about the cross-cultural studies. Since cross-cultural studies are very important to look at some things that are sort of basic human wiring. And if you think about what we call a female interest in being attractive, we may want our Armani slacks, we want our hair done a certain way, or females in our culture may do one thing. Females in another culture, for example, in the Middle East, where you're covered up with lots of scarves and things, but the teenage girls will wear just a little bit of something else showing from underneath. They have their little ways of getting the attraction of the opposite sex. Or females in different African tribes will use elongation of the earlobes, or different kinds of jewelry, or elongation of lips and ears. Things that are considered attractants to the opposite sex are things that the female brain is wired to want to do in all different cultures.
Some emails before we go to more of your calls. This comes from Judith, who says, the female brain is an enlightening book, and I've recommended it to hundreds of my yoga students. Question for the author. What happens to the brains of fraternal twins in utero? Does the male twin get lots of female hormones and the female twin get male hormones?
Great question, because as some of you may know, we've been filming a 2020 piece that's going to air on the 29th of September called The Female Brain. They've used the book for a script for that piece. And it starts off with the birth of a boy.
This is why you're going in limos these days.
That's right. Thanks, Michael. It's a new experience for me, I'll tell you. Birth of a boy-girl twin set at UCSF is how the show starts, and the boy and girl are born. They were born here in San Francisco on the 28th of April. We filmed it, and the show starts off saying this boy and girl just spent the last 9 months in the same uterus. What's different about their brains? And so then that's how the teaser for the show goes for the female brain. And if you look at female-male twin sets, actually, and there's lots of research done, of course, more in animals than in humans, but there is the tiny testicles are pumping out huge amounts of testosterone there in utero, and some of those sort of marinate a little bit, not very much, of the girl's brain. So there's some tendencies in the females in a male-female twin set to have slightly more what's called rough and tumble play, slightly more of kind of masculine behavior when they're young than, say, the average female that was a single birth or born with twin girls.
Unless we have the notion of the evil twin, something like that. Here's Ray.
Which one is that, though, Michael,
yeah,
the boy or the girl?
I'll take the fifth on that. Ray from San Jose says, I'm a business training specialist and conduct a variety of training classes in different business topics. Do women learn differently than men? What pointers can you provide to help me adjust my training classes for a more female audience? Thanks.
I love that question because, Michael, that's one of the big questions. You know, I'm talking to lots of educators these days and to the National Association of the Principals of Girls' Schools last year in Charleston, South Carolina. We had a lot of discussion about the differences in how boys and girls learn. And I think that one thing that is helpful for educators to take a look at is, the younger boys have more learning disabilities. But in girls and boys, it has to do with what they're interested in. And I think a good example is, let's take a word problems, Michael. Word math problems. If you're talking about it cost X amount to buy such and such a video game and you were given this much, how do you have much you have left over? That's going to be more interesting to a boy to think about that question. If you talked about so-and-so went to the store and she got this doll or she got this pair of something or others, that's a more of a girl interest, it's it's what the male and female brain on average pay attention to also. That's a huge importance to educators, how to get your students' attention. And, of course, if you're teaching high school, you shouldn't have any class before 10 in the morning, but that's another issue. But you've got to have something that captures the attention of your student. And if there's a gender difference in that, I think that's really a very important thing for educators to think about.
And we'll go to more of your calls from New York City. Robert joining us. You listening to us on Sirius?
Yes. No, actually, I'm listening to you online.
Ah.
Anyway, I have a question about animal studies and how they might be related. You were mentioning earlier that the male brain is more wired towards visuality and has more visual circuitry, and female brain has more circuitry devoted to appear, you know, trying to appear attractive to the opposite sex. But in a lot of orders of other animals, the relationship is switched. And would you find a corresponding switch in, say, birds, where the males tend to be much more expressive of physical appearance, and the male, and that's the female's duty to pick among them, or insects or other animals like?
Well, I just heard about peacocks, right?
Or yeah, like peacocks or mammals like deer and stags, where the male display is a primary function of sexual relationship between the two species, between the two sexes in the species. Is there a difference in those species than, say, in humans or something? Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, we got you.
Got it.
Okay.
All right.
Question.
Yeah. I think that's a real interesting question that you ask. You know, answer one, number one, you can't just take animal studies and then swap them over to humans, or humans swap them over to male, but to animal studies. However, I think that if you think also about it, yes, females are interested in how they appear, humans, maybe. But think about, we have a human equivalent of male peacocks. I mean, at least in my generation, guys like to have the fanciest car. They showed off their assets, you know, and guys still show off their assets in different ways. And when they're dating, they often, and there's a wonderful couple of studies that actually show that guys brag and they stretch the truth, and they admit to lying more than females do to try and give the impression that they're richer or they're something than they really are, in order to attract a human female at least at the college
and
age
both
level.
Sexes are pretty obsessed with size. I mean, if you were to see all these penis enlargement things that come as spam, for example, it's just as bad for men as it is for women getting a job on their memories.
I think that, you know, the thing is, female breasts are less they stick out or they don't or whatever, and females obsess about their breast size and whether they're going to be attractive to males or not, and males obsess about penis size and whether it's going to be adequate to keep a woman interested or not. So it's, I think that we
balances.
You know, balances, yeah.
Let me thank you, Robert, for your call, and on we go. Jane, join us. Hi.
Hi, thanks. Two comments, and I'll take my answer off the air. Oh, and just quick, I want to say I love you, Michael, and I've never even seen you. Anyway.
He's cute.
Symmetrical.
My two comments are, there was a caller a while back who mentioned about the suicide rate and also about women speaking, I think, two words to every one, whatever it was. My two comments are, on the suicide thing, I think one reason for that might be is, and it may be just the hardwiring in women, I don't know, that if depression sets in or difficulties, for instance, maybe in a home, the woman is more likely, not all the time, but more likely to stay and deal with it, where a man's more likely maybe to just go and leave. So I think that might be one of the reasons is women won't kill themselves because out of responsibility. And as far as the word thing, I thought it was very funny. I know things can be skewed many ways, but there was a study done, unfortunately I don't remember who did it, I think it was an Australian woman, about 8 years ago, and it was done in England, and she studied all stratas of society in social situations, and she found that men, she actually went in even among judges and all kinds of people, and men spoke something like 3 times the amount to women. And I know you can even witness this in a restaurant. You'll see a man and a woman sitting there, and the man's going on and on, and the woman's going, So I know studies can be skewed, but I thought that was kind of funny. And thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. Luann, you want to respond?
That's great. I like that, your last one. Well, think when a male is wooing a female, he has a different motivation set. So I always, yes, I think that that observation, that study is that when a man is wooing a female, he may speak a few more words. All of a sudden, he becomes a little bit more verbal than his usual.
But if my women friends are correct, in many instances, you know, you hear these bad date stories, they usually involve men talking and talking and talking, but talking about themselves. And it's a deadly mistake.
We call it bragging.
But, I mean, it's just, it turns, you know, most thoughtful and sensitive women off. I mean, if that's the only subject that's of interest to the man, you know, it doesn't exactly enhance his appeal.
Women are great listeners, you know. We're good listeners, too. We can do both.
In fact, probably ultimately much better listeners than men, I think, at the risk of sounding again like I'm generalizing.
Well, I think that what women, it's part of women's antenna for paying attention to emotional detail. I like to think of what the brain studies indicate, that it's almost as if women have extra antenna hanging out the sides of their brains for picking up all kinds of emotional nuance and social nuance in the environment. I mean, if you go to a party, say, you know, with your wife and she comes home and says, didn't you notice this or didn't you notice that about so-and-so? I don't think they're getting along. The guy may not even know what she's talking about, but she has picked up something that's subtle but significant.
Lynn Brizendine with us for the hour. Again, she is the author of The Female Brain and a neuropsychiatrist who is at UC San Francisco. Good to have you with us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow we're going to be talking in the opening hour about minimum wage, but what the kind of impact it has on labor and the economy, and why it's highest here in California, and a little bit of the history and demystifying of minimum wage as well. Hope you'll join us, and hope you will be with us every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line. That number is 415-553-3300. Thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.